This is The Listening Post on Capital Radio. I'm Tony Howes. Last week, I visited Parliament House to speak to a Member of Parliament, not about government, not about politics, but to hear his thoughts of a conflict in which he had served with distinction. I began by asking retired Major Peter Tinley how, as a serving soldier, he was able to prepare before deployment.
We're given, you know, many, many years of training, I suppose, as an individual, but collectively the SAS regiment have been around since 57 and been preparing for this and many other conflicts between 1957 and 2001. I do vividly remember my partner calling me down in the house we lived in. She said, look, there's something happening on the TV. And I was sort of, I tried to work the time out, but sort of 10 o'clock at night, I started to unfold in our time. And, of course, it was the iconic imagery now of the Twin Towers being assaulted by a foreign power, effectively, an attack on our ANZUS ally. I knew immediately as the Chief Operations Officer for the SAS that we would be part of the response. I didn't know how, what, where and when. We didn't know what was happening at the time, as in who these terrorists were and where they came from. I went straight to work to the SAS barracks in Swinburne and started positioning a concept of operations, as we call it, a CONOPS, for how the SAS capability could be deployed to a left blank moment in the CONOPS, could be deployed to the target country to assist. 2 weeks later, we're in Afghanistan. Such was the swiftness of both the American response and the enactment of the ANZUS Alliance, or invocation of the ANZUS Alliance, and the readiness of the SAS troops to go.
Can I interrupt you there? Mm. That, and this is from my naivety, when you say the readiness of the SAS, what does that mean?
So the SAS can deploy for certain missions within hours. They can deploy globally, and they can deploy with a significant strike capability, more importantly, being able to collect intelligence in a high-threat environment. So collecting information that gets turned into intelligence in a high-threat environment. So even on that basis, I knew we'd be deploying. I just didn't know where. And the Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, was very clear to Defence. He wanted a meaningful contribution that, as we found out subsequently, as we went on. And what that meant was boots on the ground, as they call it now. Typically in previous alliance arrangements and joint task force and these sorts of things, we might give a few planes for logistic support, we might do some ships protection work, all valid and a good contribution, but he was very clear that he wanted the highest risk, I suppose, in terms of the highest risk sort of presentation of Australia's commitment to the ANZUS Alliance. So that's the political will.
Hmm.
Afghanistan and Australia, our national interests probably would be a long bow to say that there was a direct national interest between Australia and Afghanistan, but we're part of a global community and we're part of a connection to our oldest and most influential ally. So it was a very easy step, I would have thought, for the National Security Cabinet, a committee of cabinet, to actually come to that conclusion.
So when you arrived, what's the sort of relationship with the Americans was in place? What did you have to engender to get a relationship going?
Well, this is an interesting thing because we hadn't worked in a serious way with the US forces since Vietnam. So 72 was the last time. And we, from that time, had a very good reputation with the Americans. We've done lots of training in between. There's a lot of what they call interoperability between our forces, so we could integrate, but never really tested in a significant way, not like this anyway. And so there's a lot of feeling out, if you like, between us. We landed in Kuwait as the advance party. I was with the then commanding officer of SAS, Gus Gilmore, an outstanding officer, and really knew what had to happen. He was very good at moving around the appropriate circles, and I sort of partnered that and moved around the circles relevant to my rank and role. And in the end, we really basically had to sell the SAS capability. It was quite straight up and down. We had a laptop with a presentation of what the SAS could do, and we'd go around telling people what we could do. To his eternal credit, Gus Gilmore, now retired General Gilmore, went to Oman, we went to Muscat, we went to Kuwait, and he went to the UAE. I didn't go on that particular jump. This is all happening in days and hours. He went and saw a little-known Marine Brigadier, that we had learnt was going to be coming in from the south and taking Kandahar. And he went to see this Brigadier General to see if he wanted our capability for pathfinding or recon or any of those sorts of things. So it was a 3,000-person invasion force coming in from the south off US carriers and the like. That general he spoke to was by the name of James Mattis, who went on to become the Secretary of Defence in the Trump administration, an outstanding soldier in his own. I'm told that Gus got through a very small portion of his presentation about the capability, and he was basically interrupted by Mattis, who knew more about the SAS than most American soldiers ever did, because he's the warrior monk that he is.
Yeah.
And we were the lead force into forward operating base Rhino, or as the landing point, and then moving up into Kandahar.
This is a bit nasty, really, when I think of it in my head to ask you. But were you thinking of success? We're all talking now about failures. But were you then thinking more of success?
Well, the thing to note is that the SAS understands clearly the strategic impact of meeting the political will. So our definition of success was to be well thought of by the Americans, to be useful, meaningful contribution. Now, to overcome some of the interoperability issues, there's this thing called NOFORN, no foreign eyes. So the Americans produce a certain level of intelligence that out of their own resources that no foreigner can see. Now, such was the trust in the end between Australian and US staff officers, particularly at the operating level, that put these missions together, is that a couple of generals took it on their own risk, on their own tick, if you like, to release information to us. And that came home in Iraq. When I went to Iraq in 2003, I went to the US in 2002 with a little tactical team to plan the invasion of Western Iraq with the US and UK counterparts. All of those barriers had gone. So it was very, 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 very helpful. And we live in a more dangerous world, but a better interoperable force between us and the US.
What you're saying, and this is corny, particularly coming from me, is the fact that the old adage about trust being the operative thing in any successful operation, that had to be established before anything else.
That's right. And you did it through professionalism. Just good people are good people, and we're all aligned with the same objective in terms of meeting the political will of the particular governments that we represented. UK were the same, and that was to remove state-sponsored terrorism in Afghanistan.
Can we wheel forward to today? What was your immediate reaction to the incredible zap of the Taliban into success for themselves?
Well, they've moved on two levels. One is a geostrategic sort of concern about what this means for the future of the region, particularly in their influences. And then personally, the people that I knew, Afghanis, who are exposed to it. Basically, after 20 years, we've consigned two generations of women back to the Dark Ages. Effectively, I don't care what they say about how they're going to respect their rights under Sharia law. And we know the interpretations of Sharia law across different sort of modes of Islam. So I don't hold any great hope. On the personal level, when we got to Kandahar, we'd been on hard rations for a long time, which is not too enjoyable for soldiers for too long. We had the capacity, once we set up in the Kandahar airport, our base, to get some fresh rations going, which is always healthy, because we had to send the boys out to some pretty tough missions, so we wanted to make sure they were fit and well. We got some catering in. It was just a humble family that came and produced some magnificent food, and it was fantastic. And there's a lot of trust developed between that family, that small business, I suppose, and us. My network unfortunately, can't seem to find them anymore. We're in contact with them through various iterations and so on, and people that remember them. So the telephone system can be a bit patchy at times, so it wouldn't be unusual not to find them for a time, but they were always there or thereabouts, and nobody can find them now.
It must be difficult somewhat for you, because if I can use that word again, there was during your period there great success in a tangible sort of way, and now everything's torn apart. What are your fears for? Or that's preempting your answer, so I'll take that out. It's not fears, but what are your thoughts when sort of US presidents talk about blaming the Afghani soldier and so on and so forth? How do you react?
Oh, look, I'm a former professional soldier, and I you know, having said all I've said on a personal level, ultimately the Australian Army, Australian Defence Force, will go where the government sends it. You put one hand on a Bible, or you certainly put one hand in the air and say, I'll go where you tell me to go. In that moment, in my view, you confer a certain moral responsibility to your government to send you to conflicts that are within the character and national interest of being an Australian. And that's why I fully support any and all investigations into any illegal behaviour, alleged illegal behaviour into Afghanistan, because we're Australian first. And we have a certain, in my view, a certain structure to our society that requires us to honour each other. So that's on the professional level, but also on the professional level, I apportion blame not on the Afghani troops, because I understand what we call the combat multiplier that morale produces. So the Taliban had the morale to withstand 20 years of occupation and then come back so swiftly. So that does tell you something. It's worth two or three times any sort of firepower, if you like. They are the victor, ultimately. We won battle after battle, but we again lost the war. And it's not lost on me the irony that yesterday, the 18th of August, is Vietnam Veterans Day and the anniversary of the Battle of Long Tan. And the imagery between Saigon and Kabul can't be more stark in its similarities. Unfortunately, we seem to not learn these lessons. I also think professionally it's a failure of intelligence to not be able to see what I've just spoken of about the morale and capacity of the Taliban and watch it come down the road and not have an exit plan that was suitable. I do believe that the US administration and I suppose by proxy the Australian administrations that over that 20 years didn't prompt the US for a comprehensive sort of extraction policy puts us in the position we're in now. So, even statements like Donald Trump when he was in power saying, almost seems like precipitously saying we're withdrawing from Afghanistan in his usual fashion, I suspect there was no detailed planning, and he caught the Defence Force or the US forces off guard. Because then why telegraph to your enemy exactly what you're going to do until you're ready to do it? But anyway, that's the circumstances we find ourselves.
And finally, Peter, when you look at Afghanistan from your experience there yourself, from your observation of both the politicians and the military, do you have any hope that, wrong word, but any sort of democratic life for the Afghanis is possible?
Look, I think our version of democracy and imposing it on another society has failed, not just with us, but with many before us. And colonialism is a failure of that as well over a longer period of time. Iraq is a very good example of a liberalised democracy when a country's not ready for it. What we didn't do over 20 years and the trillions of dollars that were spent in Afghanistan as a global community was give them more to lose by going backwards. And my example is we went into Afghanistan in the months after we arrived there. We started to burn down the poppy crops and fuel air bombs into it. And when you looked at it, and it was just simple farmers and their families trying to get ahead and make a life, we never replaced it. Australia has some of the best arid area researchers and farming techniques and technology. Did we deploy any of that? Where's the rail network? After 20 years, we didn't build a rail network that would allow them to get grains to port or silos and all the things that we know, even in our little wheat belt down here, that we could have exported to them. So those farmers and those communities had actually something economically tangible that would see intergenerational transfer of wealth. We didn't do it. The international community really does not know how to do nation building, because really, if we did, we'd have generational views about this, a 50-year view, and we'd state that we're going to be here for 50 years and we're going to help you build a society that you won't want to lose. The irony is, I went there in 2001, 18 years after I served in Afghanistan, my son joined the army and deployed to the same war that his father had fought. There's something not quite right about that when we've got nothing left to show for it.
With the Listening Post previously, we talked at great extent and a very interesting interview with Peter Boyd, CSM. And if you'll recall, at that time, I asked Peter to return to fill in the gap that we left about Afghanistan. Sadly, there's a double reason for continuing that conversation, as you know from what I've said about tonight's program. Peter, thanks for coming back and welcome back to the Listening Post.
Good evening, Tony, and thank you for having me back.
Now, before we talk about the obvious specific things that are happening now, I'd like to just ask you to tell us, how did you end up in Afghanistan?
In 2005, Australia was committed back into Afghanistan to help with the war on terror. And Afghanistan had started to implode again after being there in 2001. I wasn't there then, but with the troops there. We went back after the Iraq War. The focus had been on that, and we'd gone back to Afghanistan. So I was the I was a Warrant Officer Class 1, Regimental Quartermaster Sergeant at the regiment. The CO called me in and said, we're putting a force together to go into Afghanistan, into the Uzgan province, and set up Tarinkot as the firm base for the Australian Task Force when they established. So I flew over on a C-17 out of Perth with the CO, and that was James McMahon at the time, who's got a very distinguished service history and in Western Australia, and consequently the West Australian of the Year 2 years ago. So very good. He was a great CO and very good soldier. I went across with him and a group of others. We landed in Tarinkot, and basically it was a base that had been built by the Americans but not used, where we were going into.
Right.
It had all the fortification, but it had a probably like a large hangar without the walls. So one of my roles as the RQ was to establish a workforce using local labour that were vetted, and we got those people together and started building the camp so we could then get a firm base for when our guys came
so
in.
So, Peter, to interrupt slightly, but on key, when you were told that's where you were going, and then when you got there, what was the difference in your thinking? Were you mentally prepared for what you actually came into?
Yeah, I think the fact that I'd, like we discussed last week, where I'd been to Iraq and and gone into Baghdad, it was different. When we arrived in Baghdad, there was a lot of fighting, and I said we didn't get into the city.
That's right.
I was on the outskirts in a Ba'ath Party palace. Well, when I arrived in Baghdad the night we flew in a C-130, blacked out. We couldn't see anything because the windows were blacked out, and it looked like the 4th of July. I couldn't believe the skill of the pilots that we'd flown through this fighting near the airport, this everything going off into the sky.
Something like a film.
You know? Oh, yeah. I hadn't experienced that before. And when I landed in Tarinkot, it was quite pretty peaceful sort of area, but there was a lot going on outside the wire. You didn't go outside of the perimeter. So didn't take long to establish ourselves, but you were always on your toes because we were only a small force.
Yes.
And till it built up, we had to make sure that we were able to look after ourselves, and we had coalition backing there, the Americans and that. So, and it was a big area, a big footprint, because it took in an airstrip that was capable of landing C-130s and C-17s, and then their camp proper with inside. So you had layers of defence. So as you went in, it sort of built up.
It's a bit intimidating, surely, for any human being to suddenly have all those different personalities to have to try and work with.
Yeah.
Well, you must have had, that must have been a coping mechanism.
Yeah, I mentioned once before that something that the Special Forces pride themselves with is MARTEC, being able to adapt to the situation, being able to learn how to deal with the locals, and just being able to communicate and treat them with respect. But also, I think more so Afghanistan than Iraq, I could see that the subtleties that were same as in Vietnam for the Australian soldiers and the Americans there. You didn't know who the enemy was.
No.
They got around. They picked up a weapon. They were the enemy. Mm. So the guys that were working with you always had to be on your toes, knowing that, well, who are these guys? Where do their allegiance lie? Do they want to help their own country?
Yeah. So, or are they there to upset the whole
beeswax? Or are they in there to cause it, which...
Did you have much of that happen?
No, I had a guy that was working with me, and I had him taken away for interrogation, only because I had a sidearm on, and he was looking at me. At one stage, I was around behind a building with two of them, and we were working out how we were going to do this, and I never felt comfortable with this guy. Yeah. And I thought, well... let's just find out who he was.
Exactly.
And funny enough, a couple of weeks later, I was up near a main checkpoint where you came onto this base, and I saw an American sergeant working with a team of Afghan civilians, and this guy was in part of it. And I quickly let him know discreetly, and he was removed. I never saw him again. I think a lot of things, your own senses, your own feelings, you know, if it doesn't look good, doesn't smell good, get rid of it.
Yes, exactly. And tell me, in those early days, what was the main task for you?
Establishing a camp that we could bring the squadron in and get them into quickly. Accommodation, so we built huts, basically like the old World War II huts, sort of just a long hut. Roof on it, mainly plywood, floors just off the ground.
Materials, local materials?
Yeah, bought in.
Right.
It wasn't, there was no timber there. It had to be brought in. The Americans had lots of that, so we were able to get a hold of that and do it. A lot of these guys, I took my hat off to them, though. You could tell that they just wanted to get things better than what they'd had, and they were quite happy to help us.
Yes.
But like I say, you never really know.
Did they ever talk about the small p politics, the Taliban-y side of things at all with you?
Yeah, one thing I did see, the Americans, when we first arrived, they took this down. They had a long, high tower with guy ropes running off wire. And on the top of it, it had a thermal infrared forward... I forget what you called it, but it was a thermal camera that could look out a long way.
Yeah, yes.
And an American operator said, have a look at this. And there were two guys hanging on meat hooks in the main town. Mm. The mayor or the local mullah had put them on these hooks, dead. And it was to tell them, anyone, don't do anything in here without going through me. They were obviously Taliban, but they'd done the wrong thing. And, you knew that what they did out there, you had to be very careful, and that's how they treated their own people, so how were they going to treat
you, And talking of treatment, did that ever force you to think, why the hell are we doing anything for these people?
Not at the time, but subsequent years, and obviously in the last few days, I'm thinking, you know, and I'll just say this now, you had a defence force of the ANA and the police of up to 300,000 fully equipped, well armed, that capitulated, and they've now got all that weaponry and all that ammunition.
Yeah.
And I just see, and President Biden actually summed it up pretty well, I thought, when he said, if they're not prepared to fight for their own country, why should we lose lives taking, going back and doing this? But we do need to help certain people out, the women and children.
Yeah. So. I suppose, in a way, it's whether one believed in it or not, it's similar to the domino effect that set Vietnam off. There was the sort of, well, with the Twin Towers going and the growth of terrorism from then on, really, is this going to happen to us here in this country? And I can understand that, and I can also understand what you've just said as being the big question mark. It's a dilemma for both politicians and army personnel.
Well, there's one thing that really sticks in my mind with this. You had a force, an American force with a coalition in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Most parts of it. You have Iran, you have China, and you have Russia not far from it. You've just taken your firm base out of that footprint.
Yes.
Now what are you going to do? I just find it really surprising why you would even move out, you know.
Exactly. Well, in particular when you think, right, well, okay, yes, we can concentrate on the Pacific area, but there are entry points to the Pacific that might come directly from Afghanistan, for
example. Exactly, yeah.
I mean, now I'm not talking geography, I'm talking politics.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, 100%.
Peter, one of the things I wanted to ask you before we get on to a very serious subject, but one thing I wanted to ask you, were there any lighter moments to the troops' well-being while you're in Afghanistan that could just alleviate the sense of pessimism that we might have now?
Oh yeah, I ran into an Australian company that were putting a asphalt road past Tarin Kulp.
All right,
they'd been contracted, and They had a mix of third country nationals and South African security, great blokes and that. They had some asphalt over that they couldn't use and would go off.
Yeah.
So we needed where the little field hospital was, the Americans were running, and then our RMO, the regimental medical officer, actually worked at, which I then went and helped him with. They had this area where the helos were coming in, and the dust was terrible. And I thought, well, that'd double up as a basketball court and a helo landing court. So these guys put it down and laid it for us, and it was fantastic.
Have you ever thought of talking to our tourist industry people here on similar things?
Oh, yeah, would you do with some of that?
You
need a road building team, though.
All right, in just a moment, I'd like to return with Peter just to talk a bit more, sadly, about the great losses that our own people have suffered and others as well. But I think we need to prepare ourselves for that with just some pleasant music.
It's you, Lily Marley.
Now, Lily Marlene that we've just heard, why did we just play that?
That is the slow march of the SAS regiment, and whenever we do slow march, and it's usually only for funeral drill,
yes.
Lily Marlene is played.
Okay, well we gave the version we've given is the vocal one so that we can look at both levels, both the way of people remembering and being serious about it, but not too serious.
I think I played it in the camp when we were setting up the camps, because we had the huts and the light, and part of the song is Down Beside the Lamp.
Exactly.
Down Beside the Barracks Under the Lamp.
Yeah.
And
you did.
Yeah, and I think I played it from memory. Yeah.
Excellent. Well done. Now, as I said, this is the serious, sad bit, because I would like you to, so we can commemorate this evening, those that we've lost. Just give us some statistics to start.
Well, over the period, I was only there for a short time to set up the camp, and then I came back to Australia. But over the period of the 20 years, we had 41 Australians killed in action and 261 wounded. So, and I've made a note of just some of the other casualties throughout that war. The Americans, as of July 2018, they have lost since then, but as of July 18, 3,200 dead, 20,320 wounded. 1,720 civilian contractors that were also killed working there. So, you know, you've got a total of nearly 4,100 Americans lost their lives.
An extraordinary number.
Yeah, and, you know, when you think about over the period, there were nearly 130,000 troops in Afghanistan from 43 NATO countries. And then when you look at the up to present time, over 47,000 civilians were killed and between 66,000, 69,000 ANA and National Army and police were killed. And reportedly around 51,000 Taliban, but those numbers aren't totally confirmed. So, you know, in that whole period, you're looking at something like 175,000 people lost their lives in that 20-year war. Mm. And look where we are now.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, what we will probably never know, if, as I have, I mean, I must state my belief that I wouldn't trust the Taliban to do what they say they're going to do and excuse everybody that was an enemy and, you know, and so on. But we're going to suffer more. They are going to suffer much more as the years progress, no doubt. And the plight of the women and the schoolgirls that have just started their education, what's going to happen to their whole being?
Well, you know, I served this tour there. I did and went out. But then after I left the army, I had a business that I did a lot of work in the Middle East, and I actually went into Kabul with three ex-SAS, one Australian and two British, and we set up two compounds in Kabul. And what they were for a workforce to do work in Kabul. They were never used, the compounds. They sat there for, I believe, 1 or 2 years, just having people go through, but they weren't used for what we'd actually planned. But the one thing I noticed was a lot of women. Mm. Didn't see it in the south. You saw them a lot with the burqa and that on. Yeah. But a lot of women had businesses, beauty businesses, consulting and that. And a lot of them...
All the normal things.
Yeah, you would see here. They had the head veil on. Mm. And happy. And again, when you talk to an Arab woman, you treat it with respect like you do here, but, you know, you don't just walk up and start talking to women.
There are certain cultural differences that need to be observed.
Or you're asking on business or whatever. But I saw a lot of women there that seemed very happy, very confident, and, you know, you thought, gee, this really has changed. And a lot of posters with women, politicians and that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, today they'd all be gone. All those businesses would be shut. Yeah. And I'd hate to think what's happening to these poor women and girls.
Yeah.
So that was something that really stuck out to me.
When we talk of commemorating, that's sort of an attitude against them that we wish we would never have to commemorate.
Oh, yeah.
It's
terrible. And you could see the war damage in Kabul. It was terrible, and there were a lot of things going on always, and up to today, it's getting worse. But there was always something bad happening, but you could see there was a vibe that people felt good. You know, it was so different to what it was years before. Yeah. And
there's a light at the end of some tunnel.
Yeah, they could see that, but, they've got no hope at the moment.
Peter, when you have your gatherings of fellow SASers, if that's a term I'm allowed to use, what do you talk about?
The good times. And I think, you know, your father's an ex-soldier and you would have talked to him.
Yeah.
Not many soldiers talk about the bad times.
Nope.
There is discussion at the moment because some of our fellow soldiers are under inquiry.
Yes.
So we talk about that, but a lot of blokes talk about, and women, a lot of women serve with us, talk about the good times, the funny things that happened, and, you know, do you remember this, do you remember that?
Keeps you sane, presumably.
Yeah, it does, and it's, you know, anyone can be miserable, but you want to get around and you want to talk about the good things.
Yes. So, talking of good things, what do you think, as you think back on your time, the SAS time in particular, I mean, what do you think of is the great gain you've got from that experience?
Probably working with outstanding individuals and just, you know, lifelong friendships. And something that's quite funny, I find, I can run into someone I haven't seen for 5 years, and it's like you pick up a conversation.
Yeah.
And you only see that in the military, I find.
Yes.
And, and if you need something, you need a hand, someone will always give you a hand. They're not going to question you. You go, what do you need? And you help each other.
Well, thanks, Peter, for coming back to talk about this at this particularly pertinent time, and I think I think what we need to do now is just recall from your point of view the people we've lost,
lest we forget.
This ode awoke this morning from the darkness of a dream. This ode absorbed adversity and rose up to redeem. This ode stood tall with honour when its sentiment was penned. This ode begins with courage, and with courage it will end. This ode decrees to never let their valour go unchecked. This ode would ask for nothing but an ear of due respect. This ode defended freedom in its time of greatest tussle. This ode was there the day they fell. This ode is Andrew Russell. For Poppy Pierce's legacy, this ode lays down a rock. In all its guts and gallantry, this ode is Matty Locke. This ode reveres Luke Worsley when the bugler embarks. This ode upholds the image of Lance Corporal Jason Marks. This ode is Sean McCarthy, and I pledge to not forget. This ode is Michael Fussell, for to him we owe a debt. Private Greg Scher's quality defines the tears that spill. This ode lauds Matthew Hopkins and personifies Brett Till. This ode hails Ben Ronaldo for his fortitude forthwith. Jacob Snowy Moreland stands with Darren Smithy Smith. With Herbie by their side tonight, this ode is in their veins. Their company departed, but their memory remains. This ode is built with something that will never pierce their armour. This ode is Timmy Applin, young Ben Shuck, and Scotty Palmer. This ode declares their mateship and their brotherhood as well. The tale of Nathan Bewes is now a tale we have to tell. And the name of Jason Brown will undeniably prevail, and the truth will echo stoically alongside Thomas Dale. This ode portrays Grant Kirby as a son of parents proud. This ode is Jared McKinney, and it resonates aloud. This ode cites Richard Atkinson, his service rich and rare. This ode lifts Jamie Larkham from a place of great despair, and it sings his name eternally, the same way as Brett Wood. For Andrew Jones, his duty is forever understood. Flying free with dignity, this ode is Marcus Case. For Sapper Rowan Robinson, it fortifies his place. This ode unites Todd Langley with his comrades in the sky, and it welcomes Matthew Lambert when you look it in the eye. Bryce Duffy was a man of pride. This ode will reassert. When you frame the face of bravery, this ode is Ashley Burt. This ode unveils Luke Gavin and the beauty he possessed. For the life of Blaine Dids Didham, we are absolutely blessed. This ode belongs to Marto. From his passion it will quote. This ode gives thanks to Milo, and it treasures Robbie Pote. Take it easy, Potey. Mate, we've got you back from here. Vale Nathaniel Gallagher, whose strength is always near. This ode is Merv MacDonald, who so gamely played his part, and it holds Scott Smith securely in the contour of its heart. With selfless inspiration in the final act he shared, integrity uncompromised. This ode is Cameron Baird. Their commitment is colossal and their dedication true. This ode respects Todd Chidgey. It's for Mason Edwards too. And decent men like David Wood return from days of war who struggle to make peace with what they did and what they saw. This ode will stand beside them in the dust of every fight. In the demon of the darkest night, it hopes to shine a light. For the soldiers of this free land, for the gratitude that runs, this ode preserves the honour of Australia's fallen sons. They will never be forgotten, not today, nor ever after. This ode recalls their character, their loyalty, their laughter. Their ever-present spirit drives us onward down the road, and their flame will burn immortal with the reading of this ode.
So, Peter Boyd, CSM, before you leave us, a little annoying gadoomph has happened in my head that says to me, if I took sick and I was with you and you were in your SAS hat and the whole lot, what would you do with me and how would you deal with others in that situation?
I would firstly check you over and see how you are. And I would get you to our, especially like in my situation, yes, where I was building the camp, if you were injured or anything, get you to the field hospital. So we had a great, it was like an inflatable tent, a big one, made of different components and compartments. And they had an operating theatre in there. So if the guys were crook at all, we'd take them there. So it was like the regimental aid post, but it was a field hospital. And this was in the early days. So as it progressed, I believe they built a magnificent... so they had quite a few
things. But here I am with you at this point.
I would get you in there and the RMO and the medics. So you had American doctors, nurses, Australian doctor, and medics. So we would get you checked out. And if your injury was too severe, they would stabilise you there and then fly you on to Kandahar. And from there, as it progressed, if we had really serious injuries occurring, you'd even go on to Germany where they would take you to a hospital there and a lot of work would be done in there. We had many of our guys sent there. Not in my time while I was there. We had a couple of the boys turned up in choppers. And what would happen is whenever a helo landed, I would go straight away to the medical facility and work with our RMO Marty. And the remit was I put gloves, a blue gown, which is plastic, and over a face mask.
Right.
Just a face mask. I stood at the table and watched these guys operate on a couple of our guys, or a couple of Americans, a couple of Australians, minor stuff for the Aussies, some major stuff for the Americans, but some of the Afghans that they operated on, you know, I was within a foot, and I was helping my doc, where he would tell me what he'd want me to do, and the Americans and that. But it was such an experience to watch that, and fascinating. But something that I really found with that is when the chopper would come in, or if it was a vehicle, they'd bring in injured. And one in particular was a young boy. He was about 11, and he'd been shot in the back. So what had happened, him and his mate had jumped on a motorbike to go for a ride, just as kids do anywhere.
Yes, yes.
And whoever owned the bike, Taliban, shot the two of them. One was killed. This other bloke was injured. They brought him by helo to the field hospital and patched him up as well as they could, and then he was flown on to Kandahar. But while we were working on him, while I was standing there just assisting with whatever they wanted, I noticed he had old gunshot wounds. So this kid was 11. At some point, a couple of years before, he'd been shot before.
Yes.
Yeah, you just don't see that here, you know?
So it's amazing. He's used to, you know, the terrible thing, but he's used to being shot.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a given thing over there, you know? Yeah. So, but one thing that really stuck out in my mind, a lot of people say that the men don't treat the women with respect. Now, that is the case in a lot of cases, however.
In the extremes.
Yeah. Mm. I saw a father, they brought a young girl that had been injured, IED. She had quite a bad explosive injury to the leg, and he was crying, holding her hand. And I thought it was really nice to see that that father cared about his daughter as much as he did his boys.
Yes.
So it was really good.
Yes, these are, in a sense, the wrong word I'm going to use now, but these are the contrasts that we need to know about.
There are a lot of good men over there that do respect women.
Yes.
But when you get a force like the Taliban, they probably can't even show that sort of warmth to their daughters because or
it's
their
not
wives
on.
Because it's just not on.
Yeah.
So it's a real shame. So that was a good experience. But something that I really picked up on with this was about 2 weeks or something before I was due to leave, I went and saw Marty and I said, listen, I want to get someone else to give you a hand with this. And he goes, oh, you're great. Every time it comes in, you come and help, you do everything and you help clean up and all that. I said, I know, but Marty, I don't want to be thinking about this in 10, 20 years' time. I want time now to sort of sit back from this, do other things and do it. And I think it was the best decision I made because I talked to Vietnam vets that got on a plane and were left Vietnam and landed in Sydney hours later, and they'd just come from the field.
Yes.
Now, I flew, 2 weeks later, I flew from Tarancot to Qatar, and the next morning I was on a flight, and that night I was back in Perth.
Yes.
So I sort of think, you know, you've got to sort of think about for your own mental health, how you deal with things. And
because you've got to provide the machinery for the mind to move from dealing with one culture to back into your own.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, I think it's if you can understand that, and it's also, it makes you think about other soldiers when they come to you and they talk to you about things. Yeah. You think, well, I've experienced that. I know exactly what you're talking about, so go and have a break.
Yes.
Do this, do that.
Yeah. Last thing for you, Peter, before I really let you out and loose from Capital Radio. This is my last thing is, with the sad carry-on with inquiries and so on, how has that affected you personally?
To be honest, I'm sad for the regiment. They, 2SAS squadron was very dear to me. I served in it for quite a few years at different times. That's been disbanded. There's a lot of really good soldiers that are under investigation. I don't know how they're going. Now, on that, if they've done something wrong, it doesn't excuse them for what they've done. And I think they should face the music. But the way it's been put through the press and dealt with, I think it's pretty poor.
Yes.
And the reputation of these guys.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the PM, I've heard him say a few times with, does it pass the pub test?
Mm.
Now, people are watching what's going on in Afghanistan over the last few days, and they're going to see these soldiers being put before a war crime, and they're going to ask, well, why?
But,
but we do, we are Australian soldiers. We do have to abide by the law, and we are better than them. So I just want to make it clear, if people have overstepped the line, well, they need to be brought to bear for that. But until they're proven guilty, given the...
Well, we also stand by that tenet that you're innocent. Until
exactly. And, it's sad that it's got to where it is.
But you think we'll come through?
I think so. The regiment is very resilient. The men... you know, on the 12th of June 1996, we lost 18 soldiers, 15 of them in SAS. The next day, they got soldiers in from other squadrons. They stood that capability of the counterterrorism squadron, and they all worked together, and they went on. You know, the regiment will go on, and I'm sure a lot of the guys that are currently under investigation will prove they're innocent. And hopefully everything is good, but the regiment stays, their reputation stays intact, and
tomorrow's a good day.
Yeah, exactly.
And that brings us to the end, not of tonight's program exactly, but to that portion that we have dedicated in the thoughts about Afghanistan, and particularly in the loss of service personnel there, and also the allies that we had there, and also the local people who lost their lives or were tortured or whatever, and that's a memorial for them in many ways. I'd like to say thank you to Peter Tinley and to Peter Boyd for giving up their time for the program with their thoughts, which have been really very much appreciated. And the other credits that I must give are to the Australian National War Memorial, because they provided me with access to the music. And the poet, Australian poet, Rupert McCall, OAM, his poetry, This Ode, where he mentioned all those who had given their lives in the service of their country as soldiers in the terrible thing that we've known as the Afghanistan conflict. So those were people to say thank you for tonight's program. So thanks indeed to them all.